Guys, if you haven't checked up on our social media recently, what have you been doing? I'm at Nick Hardwick and Jamie is at jamie.hardwick. That's J-A-Y-M-E with a period and then Hardwick, which is not to be confused with the other Jamie Hardwick, who I tagged a little while ago on Instagram, and she notified me that you may want to get this straight, bud. Your wife may be pissed at you. That earned me the Worst Husband of the Week award. Sorry, babe. Anyway, you guys know that Lose Like Alignment is going off. I'm sure you've seen some of the ads circulating. Hundreds of men now are losing staggering amounts of weight on a daily basis. It's been so awesome to see. And of course, I had no idea that life would turn into this for me or for us. I just had to get the information out of my head, share it with others, see if it could help people reclaim their lives. And lo and behold, it has. And I am just really grateful to be a part of this amazing team. And the most fulfilling thing for me and the program is the weekly interactions that we get through the accountability network. So sign up for that. It is awesome to get personal connections and have conversations and get to understand who people are, what their challenges are, and assist on a very personal basis, on a weekly basis. So as this was all going on, we're getting crazy amounts of requests from the ladies wondering if this program is good for them too. And for me, I said, sure, yeah, it is. But really, since the beginning, I've tried to get Jamie to give my plan a try, and she would try it for a day or two and then basically tell me it wasn't for her. And finally, listening to the requests on social media and through email for a female version, and then getting some feedback back from females who were actually in the program and taking that into account, and then asking and not telling Jamie what could make this plan work for her and for other females, she went, took the parts from the men's program that she liked, modified it to accommodate the female body and your guys' individual preferences, and gave it a try. And I tread lightly saying this to her. Thankfully, she's not around right now. But it's been super cool watching her own this program. She has gained control back over the food, has reset her hunger cues, and has lost the weight she's been trying to lose really forever. I know. I don't think she has anything to lose either. But still, she's getting to a place where she feels great about her body. And that is important. In fact, I just get out of the bathroom and she says, I've lost this weight, but Nick, I've lost an inch off of my waist. She's taken measurements. So we sent the adjustments back to our design team, and voila, the Lose Like a Lady program is born. We would love for you guys to join the team. If you want to know more, all food preferences and eating styles work within the framework we provide in both the men's and the women's program. We do provide body weight only workouts and daily activities known as every hour on the hour exercises, EHO. But guess what? As we tell everyone, the exercise is the least important component of the plan. It's not required to lose weight. If you don't want to exercise, or you've got your own form of exercise that you would rather do, do that. We are never going to discourage that. This program will help you figure out what works best for you. You're going to learn appropriate caloric loads for the day and per meal. You're going to learn how to match your caloric intake with daily activity levels. You're going to break free from the having to eat a meal every 3 hours cycle. It really is an incredibly empowering experience. Also, the program helps build healthy self-care habits that make the program sustainable for life. And it's wonderful when you figure out that the more you take care of yourself, the healthier, the easier it is to make good choices when it comes to food, when it comes to exercise. And the best part about the program that a lot of people find is it's 4 weeks on and 2 weeks off of the plan. That is what we call a diet break. How many programs encourage you to not do the diet? We do that so you're going to build trust with yourself. You're going to take the skills you learned and you're going to put them to test in the real world. The whole process, it's incredibly empowering. When you reclaim your health, you really do reclaim your life. Join our teams. Sign up at hardwick.life. It's like hardwick.com, but hardwick.life. And use the code podcast20 for 20% off the order. And by the way, you can use that code forever on anything site-wide forever. And we want you to know that we're here for you. You can email me directly at nick@nickhardwick.com. I get back to everybody. Try it. Try me. I'll get back to you. Anything you have, show recommendations, any questions, any support, any criticism, we're here for that. Throw everything my way. You need help modifying this program to suit your particular needs? All you got to do is ask. We've helped hundreds of people make this program work in their lives, and you can too. All right, guys, back to the show. Check it out, hardwick.life, podcast 20 for 20% off, and we hope to see you on the network soon. Love you guys. Thank you. Hey there. Welcome to the Hardwick Life podcast. I'm your host, Nick Hardwick. If you've listened to the show for a while, you know I am a huge fan of self-discovery and finding more out about oneself by pushing to the individual's limits. Our guest today has done that and some. His name is Luke Tyberski, and I know you're going to get a lot out of this episode. So Luke grew up in a small Australian country town. He had big dreams of becoming a professional football, which is soccer over there, after soccer player. And after years of hard work, dedication, plenty of setbacks, he achieved his boyhood dream. Tyberski traveled the world playing the game he loved until his body started to constantly break down in his mid-20s. And as a result of that, he spiraled into a dark battle with depression, fighting off many self-harming and suicidal thoughts, suffering in silence for many years without revealing what he was going through to anybody and barely surviving every day. And one of his coping mechanisms was binge eating. Once he made the difficult decision to retire from football in his late 20s because of injury, he was lost to the crippling grasp of depression once again. And to escape the illness, he turned to extreme ultra-endurance sports and became instantly addicted. Initially, the extreme challenges, they satisfied his escapism, and I think gave him a sense of control. He ran through the Sahara Desert, down Mount Everest, through a tropical Chinese forest without food, water, or money, in a real challenge for survival, and even cycled over 400 kilometers on a Saturday just to learn how to surf the following day. Gee, Christmas. His first ever triathlon was a dull Ironman distance race, taking him 35 hours nonstop to complete. He constantly pushed his physical and mental boundaries to the limit of his capabilities, using these ultra endurance adventures as really an excuse to evade facing up to his battle with depression and the question he really needed to ask himself: what am I doing with my life? With his biggest physical challenge looming, he threw everything in a 2,000 kilometer, 12-day cross-continental ultra triathlon from Morocco to Monaco, which he had designed by himself. Yeah, that's a little crazy. And it almost broke him even before he started. In the years following the ultimate triathlon, he spent a lot of time reflecting on his actions, speaking to others about his thoughts, and listening to his body. He finally realized he had been running away from his past, vowed to turn this mode of survival into a way of living and a path into his future. And the wealth of knowledge that Luke gained from having nearly 2 years off from any physical exertion gave him another lens to view the world and his life through. And he's always eager to learn each and every day. He too is extremely passionate about helping others helping others learn what life has taught him. And Luke shares his knowledge so he can help as many people as possible become the best versions of themselves each and every day. And to me, there's nothing better than doing that. He's got a great book that I've listened to. I'm in the middle of it right now, called Chasing Extreme, available at Amazon or via his website, which is Luke Tyberski. That's LukeTyberski.com. You can also follow him on social media at Luke Tyberski. One more time, LukeTyberski. Let's get something out of this. Here we go.
There he is.
Hi, Luke.
How are you, buddy? How you doing?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Fantastic. Thanks.
Yeah, just got done with a client call.
Yeah. I got a few clients who I work with from a mindset perspective. And I've got a bunch of clients who I work with from like an athletic performance, mental performance side. So runners, mountaineers, triathletes. Alongside sort of more of the mindset, mental development clients. So it's a good mix.
Because a lot of that, right, like the extreme sports, the ultimate triathlon type stuff that we're going to get into, that is mental. Yes, it's physical, but it's super, super mental. I think there's a lot of barriers to get across there. Physical being one of them. Yes, you have to be trained properly, but
if you can't hit that switch and get it to the right space, I don't know if you've got a chance.
Well, that's it. Like, I was talking to someone the other day where I said, you can't get bored in training when you're trying to train for endurance sports, because you're going to be doing something for hours and hours on end. And if you get bored by doing the same session a couple of times a week for like an hour and a half, then there's going to be an imbalance, so to speak.
Yes. Do you find that there's a certain type of person that's drawn to endurance sports? The slow, sustained, right, where it's kind of brain type, or I've even read things recently. There's guys out like Christian Thibodeau, who's a high performance muscle builder, power lifter, weight lifter. He does all of it. And his concept that he's bringing in, which is kind of being a little disruptive, I guess, game changing, is that he's talking about being dopamine dependent, being acetylcholine dependent, being serotonin dependent, and that kind of, which brain type you are, I guess, will lead you to the path of your success. Do you find that a lot of your clients in the endurance world are of a certain type?
A lot of people get into endurance sports because they're running away from something.
Yeah.
That's why I was laughing, because that's how I got into endurance sports. And I've seen a lot of clients who I've worked with. I've seen a lot of friends, and with the world of social media these days, I see a lot of people going, there's a lot more going on in that person's life than A, they're either letting on, or B, they're even aware, and this is not going to end well. And I see year in, year out, someone who I follow, someone who's doing some really cool stuff, who I don't know, but I'm like, you know what? That train's going to crash, whether it's this year or next year or the year after, but it's coming. And a lot of people like it because they, and this is what I did. I covered over endurance sports as, and I use air quotes here, a healthy alternative to drugs or alcohol or gambling and stuff like that, an addiction to yes. make me feel good about myself. And it could go and last for hours. So it's like, I can go out for a 3 or 4 hour run and I feel amazing because all the endorphins, all the rest of it. But then also I don't have to face my problems because I'm not sitting at home in my own head and I'm not having these conversations with other people. So I love being on that high for 3 or 4 hours every day, every weekend. And there's a lot of people who are in that same boat. But there's only a certain amount of time that you can do that if you are continually running away from something and haven't addressed it in the first place. So I don't know if that answered your question, but maybe it added another element to it.
Yeah, both. And I think you obviously empathize with people that you see doing amazing feats of strength and physical challenge, and you empathize with that because you were there. There is anguish. There is something that you're running away from. There is maybe control that you're trying to get into your life. And, but I there's part of me that says, because I'm not an endurance athlete, I just, the furthest I can go is on a long walk because I've just beat the tar out of my body. And anytime I try to run, it seems like my knee's jacked up for a week and my back's all thrown out. I've done enough damage that it's like damage mitigation time. But there has to be an element too where, and I don't know if this is true or not, the furthest I've ever run is 11 miles. And I did climb Mount Kilimanjaro one time, and that was a super cool escape, just being outdoors and looking around high perspectives and doing a very challenging, but nothing compared to what you or other ultra athletes do. There has to be some sort of moment of reckoning, right? When you're out on one of these 3 or 4 hour jaunts where you go, what am I doing this for? What am I running away from? Or is there ever a part, I guess, where you come back to maybe what you're running away from and you acknowledge it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And my initial sort of response will be that's a very personal thing. And I think everyone's experience can be really different. So for me, running for 3 or 4 or 5 hours, that was fine. Like, that was never long enough for me to have to go really, really, really deep. It was always longer than that. And I think for an individual, and, you know, we can sort of say, like, we can group a bunch of people who, let's say they're running away from their past or what they're going through in that moment, or it could be mental health, it could be physical abuse, it could be money problems, it could be a multiple reasons why. But I definitely feel like when people are out exercising, because you know, like, you know, you're out and you're doing a big gym set and you feel amazing when you do it, you feel amazing afterwards. Just imagine that feeling for when you go out for, say, an ultra marathon runner goes out for a nice cruisy 3 or 4 hours. Like, we feel like that for the whole 3 or 4 hours if we're just going out for a really relaxed run. So are you really going to dig down into that dark place in the bottom of your gut, in the back of your head? No, you're like flying on cloud 9. This is awesome. My life's great. Everything's rosy. A lot of the times it's when injuries occur, when you can't do that. A lot of the times is when there's some other trauma in your life, how small it could be or it could be massive, makes you stop and look at your life. But you could be out training every day for, you know, 2 or 3 hours or whatever it is that you're doing, and you're feeling great while you're doing it. You come back and you survive your everyday life. Then you go and train, you feel amazing, and you survive your everyday life. Maybe there's parts of your life that's great that helps you get to that point where then you can feel amazing running. And then there's parts of your life that aren't so great, and you don't really have enough time to sit still with yourself unless you get injured or something else happens in your life. And I feel like that's where a lot of people are forced to literally and figuratively stop and look in the mirror and say, what am I doing? Or it could be an external factor where they've injured and they've gone to see someone and someone has just gone, what are you doing?
Because you can only keep the pace up for so long, right? And you do eventually realize that. I know all of the injuries that I faced, I had 11 surgeries coming out of the NFL. And every single time you face not just that injury, but you really kind of face your mortality as you realize that I'm getting older, this is getting harder, and you're stuck in one place, you're immobile, you don't have the abilities that you did, and you do get a glimpse into the future when you're 60, 70, 80 years old that says, this isn't going to last forever. I'm not going to be able to keep this pace up for a long time. And that's, it's hard. It's hard. It's depressive to be injured as much as I was, as much as I read that you were. I mean, that it is a total beatdown. And one thing that what you were talking about resonated with me is that the hard work is easier than really facing the issues that you may have.
Mate, that is what you call hitting the nail on the head. It's so much easier to go and run for 3 or 4 hours or ride my bike for 6 or 7 hours than when I'm injured, laying on the couch and thinking.
Yes.
You know, like, okay. Yeah. Like, I'm in a place now where, like, I'm cool with that. But, you know, for a decade, not so much. So I feel like also in endurance sports, sort of my world, swimming, cycling, running, and putting it all together in triathlon, it's a very communal sport, like all four of the sports, swimming, cycling, running, or triathlon, in the endurance section of it. And it is very communal. But at the same time, is a lot of people will spend time by themselves. But then when you're injured, that community that you go running with every Sunday, you go for a long run with like 2, 3, 4, 6 of your friends, or you have a run club where you do a tempo run or you do some intervals midweek, you know what I mean? They're not coming to the physical therapist with you. They're not laying on the couch with you, you know, like, okay, you might be on your phone or whatever, but it's not the same, you know? So there is that time where you're in a dark place because you are injured. And then you don't see people because you don't go to the track session, you don't go to the long run. So then all of a sudden you become withdrawn, and that's where it comes back to. If you are running away from something, then you really got to face up to it. So there are a lot of, and I use this in the nicest possible way, characters in the endurance world who have been running away from stuff, figured out that I don't want to stop, I don't want to keep running anymore, faced whatever they're running away from, made peace with it, and then still run. But now they're not running away, they're running towards something, or they're running because they enjoy it and there's nothing pushing them from behind. They're just like, it is what it is. Like, I've dealt with my demons. I love what I do. I've made this great community. Now I'm running towards because I'm curious how far I can run. I'm curious what time I can do. I'm curious how long I can do this thing for. And when people switch from running away from something to running towards or being curious, then it changes lives, like literally.
It's a healthier perspective. And it's really what you're pointing to is the intent behind the act, which I think is, it's the same thing. You still get joy out of the same process, but the intent going into it and coming out of it is completely different.
And that brings me to this point that I love making, is knowing why you're running. Okay, and this could be anything. Why you're strength training, why you're trying to build muscle, why you're trying to lose fat, you know, for a lot more of your community. I've been in the health and fitness world for nearly 20 years. You know, I started training my first client in 2001, I think it was, you know, so I've got the exercise science degree. I've got all the personal training courses and all this sort of stuff. And when I used to play professional soccer, I used to get bored, be finished work at lunchtime. So I used to have clients who I used to work with, you know, so I've been in that world and I'm still sort of got my toe in there a little bit because I love it, but it comes down to why you do what you do. So for a lot of endurance athletes, the last 12 months were really difficult because the reason why they trained was to race. And there's no races. Right. So they're all getting pent up going, I don't really know what I'm doing. And I said to none of my clients felt like that because we do a lot of mental work alongside the physical stuff. But I said to a lot of friends, I was like, well, why do you do races? Like, what do you mean? Is it to race to get the medal? No. What? Why do you? You know, I wasn't trying to put words in their mouth. And I said, well, what do you get out of racing? You know, and it went through this whole process. Finally, we got down to, oh, I really love running. Okay, you know what? You don't need a race to run. You know, and then I'd say even deeper, like, why do you like to run so much? Oh, you know, it makes me feel good. Okay. Nice. Let's dig a little bit deeper. And then there's the health benefits. And then a lot of the times parents say, I want to be a role model to my kids to show them if you show up every day and you train for something, and then you go and do this big challenge, this big race, this big event, you can accomplish something with that discipline and showing up every day and staying motivated and to be a role model for their kids to work hard. And that's something that I work with a lot of people, is digging down into why you run. Why do you turn up to the gym every day? You know, if you're a bodybuilder and you're trying to, you know, build muscle, lose fat, and it's a very restrictive way of living for a period of time. And that, like for me, like, I don't have a problem with that. If that's what you want to do, cool. But you've got to really know why you're doing it, because when you're sick of eating chicken and broccoli and you've still got 2 months before your show, it's like you really need to know why you want to do that, why you want to lift weights, why you want to, you know, do everything that's involved to get you on stage looking the best that you can. If you don't have three or four truly deep-rooted whys, then it's going to be tough.
I think that's a great point, is that three or four truly deep whys, because we have such a way as humans of rationalizing something out, right? Where, I don't need to get the weight off. I'm fine. It'll be okay. I'm living a good life, living my best life. But then when your other why is, oh, my kids, my wife, or the community that I'm trying to serve, or, you know, eventually you go, I've got four really good whys, and it's kind of buckets as needed, of motivational buckets as needed, and go dig back into those whys. Do you encourage your clients to have multiple whys? And do they cover multiple areas?
Yeah, I get my clients to build a why tree. So basically, cool. There's three levels. I'll give you the short version. There's three levels. There's the leaves, there's the branches, and there's the roots, right? So you think of a tree. The leaves on a lot of trees, right, they come and they go during the seasons. And when it's really windy and when there's storms, the leaves get blown off. But the tree needs leaves, right? It needs it. It makes it look pretty. That there's certain things that the leaves help to function with the tree. So for a human, I look at leaves, like on this Y tree, as the superficial Ys. And I mean that in the pure sense of what superficial means, not so much in like maybe what it means in the 21st century, but on the top layer. So the superficial Ys, you know, like let's say for running, it's like, oh, I like medals when I finish a race, because everyone, like as adults, gets a medal when they finish a race, which, you know, we're changing that in kids, but in adults, we're still doing it. So, you know, little Jimmy doesn't get a medal because he finished 6 out of 8 at a school thing, because they're changing, you know, to giving everyone a medal. But, you know, mummy finished 6,772 out of 15,000 people and she gets a medal. I only take medals if I finish on the podium or win. And it's, you know, you finish a 100-mile race or a 100K race I did 18 months ago, and the woman was like, well done. You know, I've done 100Ks so many times. She went to give me a medal and I was like, no, that's fine. Why not? I said, did I win? Well, no, it's not about that. Did I finish on the podium? No. For me, I'm okay. I don't need a medal. You know, I've got that experience of running for the last 12 hours. That's a personal thing. But also it parts to make up for, I don't do it for the medals. So a lot of people do. They're the superficial whys. Then we've got the branching whys. And a lot of the times, this is what people think their deep-rooted whys are. So the branching whys, they're strong, right? They're structural. They're connected to the trunk. They're nice and strong. The wind comes, they're there. So your adversity comes and goes, structurally fine. The seasons change. Nothing changes there over time. So they think, yeah, these are the deep-rooted whys. These are the ones that we latch onto. But really, they're branching us down to the roots. So for runners, this could be like a personal best time, you know, the furthest I've ever ran, maybe finishing on a podium, you know, or it could be because it's healthy. I want to improve my health. I want to lose weight. So these are all things that people may believe are their deep-rooted whys, but really I look at them as the branching whys. It's when you get there, you've got to ask the question, why do you want to lose weight? Why do you want to get your PB down to whatever it is? Why do you want to run a 100-mile race? When you start taking time and dig down lower, then you get to the deep-rooted whys. And like roots of a tree, there's multiple, and they go off in all different directions. So yes, there are multiple types and different variants, but also the point I want to make is when you spend the time to go through your superficial whys, your branching whys, and enable yourself to dig down a little bit and entrench those deep-rooted whys into the earth, so to speak, then what happens to the tree when there's a huge tornado? You know, if they're strong, the trunk stays upright, the branches are gone, the leaves are gone, but the deep roots of that tree keep the tree upright, keep it alive. So after a while, it can regrow. So knowing multiple deep-rooted whys and thinking of it as a root of a tree where it comes down, there's other branches of roots going off. So it might be a personal, you might have a personal element of a root and you go out and there's a bunch of personal ones. Maybe there's a family element as well, as I talked about, being a role model for your kids. Maybe you're doing it because your parent was a runner and you're doing it quietly because that's the reason why you want to do it, because you want to follow in their footsteps. If that's really you digging down, I don't know, I'm making these up as I go now, yeah. But you get the idea of the deep-rooted whys going off in different directions, but you need to take time to dig down and really figure out the underlying reasons that are going to get you through you know, I say 100-mile race when you've done 75 miles and you've still got a marathon to go pretty much, and you've been going for, let's say, 20 hours and you haven't slept all night, you really need to know why you're there.
So how many of these have you run?
100-mile races?
Yeah.
I've only done a couple of 100-mile races. I've ran 100 miles just for fun, not in a race, a few times. I've done a lot more multi-stage stuff. So I've done probably a dozen times where I've ran 160 miles in sort of 5 days. But yeah, ultra marathons, like 50 miles plus. I couldn't tell you how many I've done.
Countless.
Yeah. Yeah. And races, I could probably have a guess how many races I've done, but how many runs longer than 50 or 60 miles, I can't remember. Because my driving force is not to do races. One of my deep-rooted whys is the adventure.
That was going to be the next question. Yeah. Because you've had to, and then I'm assuming this is what you help clients do, you had a moment where you realized that I was running for not the wrong reasons, but you were running to get away from something, to get control. But then you had a 2-year kind of hiatus from really anything physical, because you beat your body to tarnation. And then I'm assuming during that 2 years was when you really reconciled what was going on in your past and were able to move forward kind of with a better lens. Take me through that whole period and how that happened.
Yeah. Well, firstly, Nick, is 2 years a moment?
I guess universally speaking, it would maybe be a moment in one of our lifetimes. Goodness, that's a long time. It's a long time.
So basically, for all the listeners who haven't done their research, like I know you have, with the questions that you've been asking, which is awesome, I'll give everyone a bit of a recap and sort of get them to sort of what we're talking about.
Cool.
It will really enable them to make more sense of to answer that question of that moment that I had. So I used to be a professional soccer player, bounced around the world in the lower leagues, battled with my mental health towards the end of my career. Had a bunch of injuries, 3 surgeries in 11 months. Not 11 like you, but, you know, I also didn't play in a sport like the NFL.
And it's not just the surgeries, though, that tell the story. I mean, there's soft tissue injuries that don't require surgery that also keep you on the sideline. They keep you from... And there were so many, listening to the book Chase It Extreme, there were so many moments in there where you are right on the precipice of making that roster and really seeing the childhood dream come to absolute fruition, and then you pop a hamstring. Or the one that was devastating to me was the one where you had got the scholarship to play at Louisville, I think it was, and then you... unknowingly and just naively took a professional contract, and then you lost your scholarship when you came back to school. And I thought, oh goodness gracious, he didn't know any better.
I'm sitting at the compliance office at University of Louisville, you know, big school, got recruited there, you know, made co-captain, was going to help change the program, like all the rest of it. And I got caught in the compliance office with the coaches. And the compliance officer said, Luke, I need you to be completely honest. I need you to be open. And I was like, yeah, cool. Okay. Have you ever signed a professional contract? And before she even said contract, I was like, yeah. tell you what, talk about sucking the energy out of the room. Everyone's just going, oh. And I'm like, what do you mean? I played professionally. I signed a professional contract for about 3 years in Australia before I came to America. And yeah, so that wasn't a physical injury, but not knowingly, I literally, you know, chopped my legs off underneath my knees with that simple, you know, word of yes, of course I have. But
yeah, plead the fifth.
Yeah, well,
yeah, plead the fifth.
If only I knew.
I know.
So yeah, so I had a lot of soft tissue injuries, countless injections. Countless tears, you know, just ridiculous amount of soft tissue injuries alongside the three surgeries in 11 months on three different body parts. And that wore down on my mental health. And I started to battle with depression. I didn't speak about it for many years, didn't speak about it with my girlfriend at the time, didn't speak about it with my housemates. No one, even my closest friends, didn't know. And then there was this transition phase where I decided that I was going to retire from soccer on a little calf strain. Like, it was crazy. I tore my calf three times, not tore, sorry. I strained my calf like three times in 4 months, whatever it was. And the third time I was just like, I'm done. And I pat myself on the back and I walked home. I was like, you know what? My career's been great. It hasn't quite got to where I wanted to go, but I bounced around the world playing professional. Awesome. And then I got home and I sort of realized, now what do I do? I'm 28. I've got an exercise science degree and I coach these sort of people on the side, which is cool, but it's never really what I've wanted to do as a full-time career. It's always like, I really love doing it part-time. And I was a bit lost of identity, iced my calf, and then it hit me. It's like, holy crap, who am I if I'm not a soccer player? What do I do now? And my mental health plummeted, and I just needed something to stop this snowball going down the side of the mountain. And for some crazy reason, a thought came into my head of my friends in Australia who'd done Ironman triathlon and marathons and ultra marathons, who, mind you, I used to tell them, coming from my exercise science degree, that they are taking years off their life doing things like Ironman triathlon. Marathons are going to kill you. You're going to die at 70 because they're ruining your immune system, your skeletal system, and all this. So here I am sitting on my high horse telling these people, that like best friends of mine who I've known since we were like 10, that they're crazy. And I thought, if they can do it, I can. So I literally remember this race that they told me about where you run 6 marathons in 7 days through the Sahara Desert. I looked it up. I found it. It was in 6 months. I called them up and I said, can I have a place? And they were like, oh, well, there's a waiting list. I'm thinking, waiting list? Why would there be a waiting list for a race where people run 160 miles in a week through the Sahara Desert? There's not that many crazy people. And anyway, apparently there was, but she said if people are pulling out, if you pay your deposit now, then you can get a place. I'm expecting, okay, sort of in like US dollars, I'm expecting like, you know, maybe $1,000 or $2,000, you know, because it was a whole week long thing, right?
Right.
Anyway, when she's like, I can't remember how it was now, like the deposit was like £3,000. I'm like, well, how much is the whole race? So anyway, so I basically trained for that for 6 months, dumped all my savings into paying for the rest of the race, buying all the kits, buying running shoes, socks, everything. So I wasn't a runner. And set off on this journey, and we're moving towards to answer your question now, set off on this journey to be this endurance adventurer, I called myself, where I was going to do the biggest, highest, hottest, wettest, craziest races around the world, swimming, cycling, and running. I didn't have a running background. I was a soccer player. I didn't have a swimming background. I could swim, but I didn't swim in any races or anything like that. Cycling, I used to cycle an old mountain bike to friends' places, but that was it. So I went off on this big endeavor to be this endurance adventurer where I was going to do all these crazy challenges around the world, have documentaries made about them, write books about them, speak on stages around the globe about these big challenges that I was going to do. And I thought, you know what? I need to do something really big to put me on the map. So I came up with this event called the Ultimate Triathlon. And it was a swim, cycle, and run from Morocco to Monaco. So the Strait of Gibraltar goes from Africa to Spain. This is the mouth of the Mediterranean Ocean, the sea. And I was going to swim that and then cycle the entire southeast coast of Spain, which was about 800 miles, and then run a double marathon every day for a week to finish this 2,000-kilometer triathlon in 12 days. I gave myself about 4 years from when the concept first came into my head to complete it. So talk about running away from something. for the next 4 years, I literally spent any money I could find, drained every bank account I had, any money I made from training clients, writing magazine articles, doing these challenges, getting sponsorship from brands. I made no money, but anything I made, I put into doing the next adventure, right? Because I was like, I'm going to give myself 4 or 5 years before I actually start making money, as long as I can cover costs. And that was it. So on the outside, Luke looks like he's doing really cool stuff. Yeah, running down Everest, spending time in Nepal, high up in the rural mountains for like a month, you know, running through a forest in China, climbing mountains in New Zealand, doing all these crazy challenges, writing these articles for magazines, speaking on stages. It's like, yeah, like Luke's got his act together. But in reality, I'm battling with depression. I'm binge eating. I stood on tops of bridges twice, not wanting to live. I had insomnia for about 2 years. I had a relationship breakdown, and it was ruining me on the inside. So for 5 years, I was beating myself up physically by doing all these ultra endurance challenges. For 2 of those years, I was sleeping anywhere between 8 and 20 hours a week. You know, so some days I wouldn't even go to bed because I got to like 1 o'clock in the morning. I can't sleep. Fine, I'm going to go and run a marathon. And I would get back at like 5 in the morning and I'd have a shower and I'd make some coffee and I'd sit down and my flatmates would come out and be like, oh, you go for a morning run. Yeah, just did a little 10K at like 6 o'clock in the morning and now I'm just here having breakfast. You know, little did they know, I never went to bed and I ran a marathon at 1 o'clock in the morning. So this was my life, you know. And then some nights I was like, I can't go and run because I'm exhausted. My legs hurt. To make myself feel good about myself, I'd smash a whole tub of like Ben and Jerry's ice cream and, you know, a big bag of nuts and then wake up or just sit there in my bed or go to sleep for a few hours, wake up feeling like absolute rubbish, physically, mentally, emotionally. So I wouldn't eat for 24 hours. Would not put anything in my mouth apart from water for 24 hours or I'd
to
wake up.
To punish yourself.
Yeah. So because the thing is, I didn't want to put on weight. So I was like, okay, well, if I just ate 4,000 calories and I don't eat for 24 hours, that makes sense. I'll go for a run and then I'll reset me. Like emotionally, it made sense. I knew better because of my education, but emotions were overrunning that. So these were the type of behaviors that I was having, and it got bad to the point where, as I said, like I went and stood on top of a bridge and didn't want to be here anymore. So
what stopped you?
What stopped me? It's a really good question. And it's one that I've spent years thinking about. And it wasn't until only a few years back where I actually realized what stopped me. And it was the fact that when I was standing there, and like I have no real recollection about this, like for years after, it was only when I stopped and did a lot of therapy and did a lot of self-reflection and dug deep into that memory. And I don't know what it's called. I can't remember the term, but where you put yourself back into that memory. So I didn't go and stand on bridges, but I went and looked off a higher space in a safe way and put myself back to that place and go, right, okay, what was I thinking? And it was a fact that, and I'm super close with my parents, I knew the pain that I was going through was bad, but if I took my own life, I knew the pain that my parents would go through would be worse than the pain that I was feeling in that moment. And I was okay with hurting myself, but I was not okay with knowing the amount of pain that I would cause my parents. And that almost made me snap out of it and take a step back. And those times where I stood on the edge of the bridge, I could have been there for 30 seconds. I could have been there for 30 minutes. I don't know. All I can really put myself into is the fact that I realized how badly I would hurt my parents and the pain that I was going through at that time wasn't as bad as that. And that's what pulled me back.
I could tell in the book how close you were to your parents, and that was just very apparent in so many spots along the way, that you could tell some of the questions that they asked you or later revealed to you that they were thinking behind the scenes. Did they have any idea that you were dealing with mental health issues? Because I think it's, and this is something, it's really personal to me. One, I just had a friend that I lost that from outward appearances had everything going. Life was good, beautiful family, great kids, business was good, made as much money as you could ever possibly need for three or four lifetimes, and everything seemed great. And then all of a sudden we get a call altogether, or now we find out on Twitter, you know, that a friend had passed. And, you know, I take myself back to when I even retired from the National Football League, and I thought I had everything going for me. I had a job lined up. I had started down another path. Everything was perfect. I had a beautiful wife, two young kids, and everything was going so well. And then all of a sudden it was like I fell off the emotional cliff. And thankfully my wife was there. When I told her, I said, hey, I'm not going to go to work. I'm done. In fact, I'm going to give you all of my money and I'm going to go to Nicaragua. Leave me with $1 million and I'll just make do down there. And I had no idea what the hell I was going to do in Nicaragua, but that was just kind of the thought. But from the outside, she thankfully was there and looked at the babies and looked at me and said, like, you're not going anywhere. We're going to get you help. We're going to face this issue. But I think, and this may be true with all people that are going through mental health, but I think professional athletes have a way of facing the media, facing the public, and putting on a happy face with friends and being able to compartmentalize. And like your buddies would come in the morning and you're having breakfast. Oh, did you go for a morning run? Yeah, everything's great. No, don't worry about me. I just ran a marathon starting at 1 a.m. Did your parents have, did anybody close to you, were they able to perceive anything? Because my friends and I are still kind of going back through losing a friend, and we all feel, of course, a part of it and to blame for it because we didn't stay close enough or connected enough. But those that were even really close to him still didn't have really any indication that that was going to happen. Is any signs you were given, other than, because, you know, by outward appearances, you're climbing mountains, you're doing super cool feats of human performance. Yeah, you're balling, right? On Instagram, you're balling, but, you know, it only goes so far.
Yeah, 100%. Look, no one in, so I live in London. I was living in London at the time. No one in London knew what I was going through. You know, the people I live with, my girlfriend at the time, my sister, my close friends. And I can say no one knew anything, because since everything came out in my book, Chasing Extreme, that you were mentioning, and all my friends read it, everyone, like, I don't think everyone who's super, super close, you know, like your handful of friends who you know that you would tell them anything and they would tell you, is they have all said to me in one way or another, or in their own way or point blank, dude, I had no idea that you were going through that at all. So people who were the closest to me from an emotional standpoint and also a physical standpoint, who we used to see on a daily, weekly basis, they had no idea. Like, I was a very good actor. But, you know, I used to talk to my parents most weeks on Skype, and, you know, I've been doing that for years. And when I first left Australia, it was, you know, the old calling cards with the number, you'd scratch off the number, and the number to call was 25 digits long, and the PIN number where you would pay like $10. I first went to America when I left Australia. You'd pay $10 and you'd get like 12 minutes to call Australia. That was hilarious. I think about it now, when you can just FaceTime it with a push of a button. So we
kids don't know the struggle.
No, exactly.
They don't know the struggle's real.
No, you used to put that code in, you get one wrong, and it'd take you another 10 minutes.
That's the truth. Yeah. And don't do it from a hotel room, because that'll always jack you up.
Yeah, yeah. You learn these things. So, we used to always talk. So then when we're in the UK, I would Skype most weeks, and there was a period where things were real bad. It was after my long-term relationship broke down, and like I was struggling with that, and that almost, I was able to let my guard down a little bit with what I was going through, because I had a reason of why I felt flat and depressed and lonely and upset and all these sort of things, because my 5-6 year relationship just broke down. And it wasn't my choice, wasn't my decision for it to break down. So that hit pretty hard. To sum it up, I got my heart broken. So yeah. Anyone who's felt that knows what it's like. And yeah, that I had an excuse to feel really flat. So I was like, I'm going to use that for a period of time. And it was only when I let my guard down because of that, my parents, especially my mum, saw straight through it. She knew that there was something else going on. And I know this because she said, do you want me to come over for, a couple of weeks? Like from Australia to the UK, 24 hours on a plane.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, do you want me to come over for a couple of weeks? Like, my parents are very working class. My dad's a builder. My mum's a secretary. They both still work in their mid to late 60s. And like, one, it's just like, well, mum, how are you going to get 2 weeks off work? Two, how can you afford it? And three, no, I'm fine. I'm all good. I'm just a little bit upset about what's happened, but I'm okay. But they knew. They could see straight through it. And my parents know me very well, and they know that you can ask me and you can push a little bit, but they know not to push too much, because then I'll just go the other way and be like, no, fine, and move further and further away. So they stop asking. I will distance myself. And I've always done that when I've been pushed too far and it's not something that I'm interested in. Instead of trying to fight back, I will just distance myself. And so they pushed a little bit and it wasn't going to happen, so they stopped. And years later, it came up a little bit throughout the book Chasing Extreme, but years later we had this amazing conversation. I went back to Australia about 6 months after the book was published. Obviously, they read the first draft, not when the book came out. And I had this amazing conversation with my mum for about 2.5-3 hours, just the two of us, about what I'd been through, about the book, any questions she had. And it was fantastic. It's some of the best quality time I spent with my mum. And she said, like, I knew that you were struggling, but I know my son Luke, and I couldn't just turn up on your doorstep, because I knew that it could backfire, or you would just push whatever you were dealing with down. And I had a great conversation about 90 minutes with my dad about it, just the two of us. My dad came from a migrant family from Poland to Australia after the war. He left school when he was like 12 or 13 to become a builder. Got the most common sense I know of anyone. Yeah, but obviously he left school when he was 12, so there's things in his education where there's a few holes. So he's not the most deep and meaningful man to have a conversation with, but we went deep for us. And yeah, he was just like, I could tell it in your voice. And I said to your mum, there's something wrong, and your mum was like, I know, what are we going to do? We can't just turn up, we can't keep pushing, because he will just go the other way. And so they were having these conversations on the other side of the world, but everyone who was seeing me on a daily basis had no idea.
You brought up the word in there when you were talking about your long-term relationship. I think that was with a Pilates instructor, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So
funny how you remember that.
Yeah. Heartbreak. Right? It was heartbreak. And as you said that word, when I think back to losing my NFL career, being done with it. As much as I thought I was ready to be done with it, I think I was heartbroken that it was over. And yes, there's so many other things that are tied into it: identity, purpose, passion, decision making. Wildly easy while you're playing a professional sport. Like, does this get me closer to the goal or not? If it does, yes. If it doesn't, no. It's super easy. But you also, it's your childhood dream. You're in love with what you're doing, and then you lose that, and then you're heartbroken about it. And I think that was honestly the first time in my life that I had been crushed by something. And I think a lot of guys eventually end up going through that. What was, when you look back at your mental health before kind of revealing to mom that things were going bad, and when you look back at your professional career, maybe before it ended, when you said you were battling with mental health, what was going on during that time that was struggling? Was it the injuries? Was it the downtime? Was it not? What was it? Do you know?
It's a good question. A combination of things. Like, you know, if you asked me a couple of years after it happened, you know, I would give you just an off the cuff answer. And this is, you know, I retired in 2011, so I've got nearly 10 years of self-reflection to look back. And look, Nick, I think it's a combination of the injuries were getting to me and the stop start of going to a club, not getting a long-term deal. And I'd never been in that place before, whereas always every season I, you know, even as a kid, as a teenager, when I'd sign those professional contracts, at the last minute, you know, so I would get a call, or my agent would get a call and say, hey, they've got this final trial day. They're looking for a defender. It's basically between you and four other guys. Go and play 90-minute game, kick ass, and you'll get a deal. And it's like, cool, right, no worries. And I always fell into a season. I was like, I'm here for 2 years, and then I chose I was going to go somewhere else. So there was never a time where it was more than a season where I wasn't actually with a club. So I think there was that, the uncertainty, the injuries. Look, the relationship I was in that we talked about, it lasted 5 odd years. It should have lasted 5 months in reality. It was very unhealthy. One of my best friends who I grew up with, I've known since we were 8 years of age, and he literally in London, like, so I obviously knew him in Australia. In London, he lives a mile from me now. He literally lives down the road. And he knew my ex-girlfriend, whatever, and years after it happened, something came up about it, and he was just like, yeah. He and his partner were like, yeah, we were so surprised that lasted so long. The first time I met her, he said, I went home and told my partner, yeah, that'll last about 3 months. And I'm like, dude, why didn't you tell me?
That's so true. That is so true. Friends need to be better friends and tell you when it's not right for you.
Well, at least sort of like pull the blinker away from your eye and say, yeah, have a look for yourself. Like, it's your choice, dude, but this is what we can see. And if you're close friends, like, yeah, you might be pissed off at them in that moment, but if they're close friends, then you're not really going to care. At least gives you an opportunity to maybe take a step back for a moment and have a look. So, yeah, like the uncertainty of not playing regularly, not being with a club, not making money on a regular basis. Like, you know, I didn't play in the Premiership. Like, you know, I didn't make NFL money or Premiership right. money. You know, I was, if I could cover my bills for the year and I had a few thousand pounds in the bank at the end of the season as a 23-year-old, I'm winning, you know? Because like, yeah. I'm like, I know where I can get, where I can make some, you know, okay money if I can make the right path and I can get a lucky break, so to speak. But I never quite got there, but I always, you know, covered my own. But for me, I was just like, it's my childhood dream. I'm not doing it to make money. I'm not doing it to set myself up for the future, because like, I know I can have another career, but this is what I love doing, and I'm going to give myself the best chance of doing it now, because when I retire at like 30 or 32, like I thought back then, I will have had an awesome 10, 12 years, and now I'll continue the rest of my life. So the uncertainty, the financial uncertainty, being in a bad relationship, the injuries, all of that combined was the driving force behind why my mental health started to decline, why I became depressed, why I started to binge eat, why insomnia started, why everything happened. It sounds really simple, and if you think about it, yeah, it's obvious. But man, as I said, it took me about 7 or 8 years to figure that out.
But I think the cool thing in that is that it doesn't have to be complex. It doesn't have to be one traumatic incident happened. It was kind of a compounding effect from a bunch of different influences and factors that ultimately beat your mental health down.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's really cool to hear.
Yeah, and one thing that you said before about heartbreak, and as you talked about your NFL career, and it's the first time that you were heartbroken when you retired. And one of the things that I had to do, I guess this is potentially we can pull this conversation around to that question you asked me a few minutes ago, was that period of time, that moment where I had to stop. One of the things that I didn't realize that I didn't do was grieve for the loss of soccer, of football, of my career, right? So for me, the grieving process, we think of that as when we lose a loved one. Yes, 100%. But in reality, I believe whenever you have a strong emotional connection to something, and that can be a job, a career, a relationship, a sport, an animal, and a human, where you've got this massive, strong emotional connection, when that's broken, then we need to spend some time to grieve that loss. And I went from the mindset of I'm a professional soccer player, I just got injured again, okay, I'm retiring right now, to I'm going to be an endurance adventurer and travel around the world and do all this crazy stuff. There was no time to grieve. So that emotional anguish that was building up was compounding year after year after year. So 2011, I retired and I signed up to the Marathon des Sables, the crazy desert race.
Yeah.
I did the ultimate triathlon in the end of 2015. So 4 years later. And then it was only really at the start of 2016 when my body started to shut down. And this is what you alluded to, that moment, that two-year moment where I was forced to stop. And I'll continue that train of thought before I finish answering your question. The initial question was, it was only then in start of 2016, after I retired in 2011, that I stopped and grieved for the loss of soccer in my life, for not being a soccer player anymore, not being a professional soccer player. Like, it took me that long to stop. So you can imagine all that built up tension, that emotional anguish was going on for like 5 years. On top of that, after the ultimate triathlon, after all of those years of the binge eating, the overtraining, like I'm doing 25 to 30 hours of swimming, cycling, and running and strength training a week, plus training clients, plus speaking on stage, plus organizing these big events. Like I don't have a team. I don't have people who work for me. I was doing everything myself.
It's you.
Yeah. So I'm doing 25 to 30 hours of physical training a week, doing another 25 to 30 hours of other work a week. Add that to physical tiredness and not sleeping and binge eating and all that sort of stuff. Like for 5 or so years, my body was due to break. And after the ultimate triathlon, it did. My endocrine system shut down. I had problems with my nervous system. I had to go and see a neurologist because I was having headaches for like 6 hours a day. And I had to go and see the neurologist and say, look, dude, what's going on? And we had a bunch of different scans. And he's like, you know when a light bulb is flickering and you just turn it slightly and it stops flickering? It's like, yeah. It's like there's this tiny section of your brain that's basically doing that. So because of all of this built up, you know, nervous system strain. So he gave me some medication for like 4 months, and eventually that cleared it up. Like, my adrenals were shot. I went and saw a really cool sports physician who used to be a professional triathlete, and she's right into a holistic approach to life, holistic approach to medicine, but, you know, she's still an MD. Saw her, highly recommended, and we worked together for a period of time, and I was on all these different, like a lot, most of them natural supplements and medications to basically reset my endocrine system,
right,
and help out with my nervous system and all the rest of it. Having regular treatments with my now wife, who's an osteopath. Working with her from a physical perspective and from an emotional perspective, because she was the first person I really opened up to. And she was so supportive. And I say this all the time, and I truly believe it, is I don't think I would have got to where I am today in the way and as quick and as linear as I did without the support of her. I'm not going to say that without her I wouldn't have got here, but I think I got here a lot quicker and in a lot linear way with her support. And I think that comes from her personal life experience and also being an osteopath. You know, she sees the body, she sees the world, she sees recovery from a holistic point of view from many different angles. So we work together professionally and personally. And then I just needed to rest. I needed to stop because I could barely walk a mile without having to sit down on the bench and be exhausted. So when you go from, you know, doing 20 to 30 hours of exercise every week and then doing all this other work to then your body crashing and going, not anymore, you've got a lot of time, as we talked about being injured earlier, to sit on the couch and think about, what am I doing?
Yep.
So that was my moment. You know, like 6 years of running away, my body forced me to stop, to say, dude, you need to grieve about soccer. So let's do that. You need to completely move on from your previous relationship, even though it was like 3 years gone and I was in another one, a very loving one. So loving that we've now been married for nearly 4 years and all is good. And also, you need to figure out now who you are, how you want to live your life, and what you want to do in it, and give yourself something to move towards. And it was only really, and you say 2 years, like a lot of times I will quote 18 months, but you're right, it was 2 years, because it was only when my book came out, when the last piece of the puzzle, the binge eating and standing on tops of bridges and wanting to take my own life. The first time I talked about that was in my book, and that came out 2 years after when my body forced me to stop. So the first time my parents, my now wife, she didn't know about it. We were living together and she still didn't know about it. And everyone knew that I was binge eating and had these suicidal tendencies was in the first draft of my book when I gave it to them and said, you know, about 80% of what I was going through, there's a little bit more in here where you'll be shocked and you'll be upset, but just know I'm okay. And that's when they read that. And so, yeah, 2 years after my body shut down, I published my book. And that's when the whole world knew every single skeleton that was in my closet. Now I joke that I don't have a closet anymore because I opened it up, threw it out to the world in the book.
It's beautiful and well done. And I love the book. Actually, I'm listening to it. And you narrate it, which thankfully, because you got a great voice. Because sometimes books aren't good, but you know the substance. It's not that the book's not good. The substance is good. But if it's not read by the right person, it just doesn't come out right. But you got a great voice. It's your story. And then what I really like about the book is that you have these little sidebars at the end of chapters or end of parts of it where you go back and you reflect naturally. And it's not reading. It's just kind of a natural reflection on the topic that was just covered. And I think there's some really good juice that comes out of there. Luke, we're coming up on time. Give me, what are you doing now? Where can people follow you and learn more about all that you got going on? And what I like about this is it's a much more methodical approach than when you first started.
Yeah. So what am I doing now? I'm still doing big, crazy challenges, but I'm moving towards things. I'm raising awareness. I'm raising money for mental health. I'm working with a coach, a world-class endurance athlete coach, who liaises with my wife, who's my physical therapist, you know. So we've got a team together now. But I'm still doing big stuff. I've got a big challenge coming up this August, which I haven't announced yet. So you can follow me on at Luke Taberski on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, everything. My website's luketaberski.com. But yes, I still do that. But my day job, so to speak, is speaking and conducting workshops for professional teams, corporations, organizations, on really trying to express why mindset matters, why training your mind on a daily basis matters to help with mental health and mental performance. And they go together in one. And it's a combination of my life experiences, the workshops that I do and the talks that I deliver, my experiences, my education, my further education and knowledge from my own personal reading, and just my life of learning, you know, from my mistakes and how I'm able to actually continue to push myself physically and mentally. So I've been able to extract the mental framework that I actually have. And I just thought everyone used to think like me, but then I realized not everyone did. So I'm sharing that with companies, organizations, sporting teams. Like, I'm talking to a big professional rugby club over here, to their academy players, to their first team, and doing like a three-part workshop. So I do a lot of that type of stuff.
That's great.
I've got a few coaching clients who I still work with from a mindset perspective, who don't really do any physical exercise. And then I've got a few clients who I work with on the running side. I write their running programs, strength and conditioning programs, and do a lot of mental work with them. Mountaineers, people who do all different types of crazy sports. So I've got a bit of everything, and that's basically what I do now. And I've got a couple of documentaries out on Amazon Prime called The Ultimate Triathlon and the 500 Man. And, yeah, my book on Audible, Chasing Extreme, which you're listening to, and appreciate your support.
Awesome, Luke. That was great. That was great. Thank you.
No worries, man. Hope you enjoyed it and your listeners will get something out of it.
Yeah, and I'll definitely go watch Ultimate Triathlon and 500 Mile Man.
500 Man.
500 Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, that gives me something to do while I'm working out. I love listening to your book while I'm working out. I'll watch videos while I'm working out, put them up on the screen and listen to it and take a look. So yeah. Thank you so much for the time. And to get a hold of you, it's Luke Taberski, LukeTaberski.com or at Luke Taberski. So, Luke, that was fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Nick. I'm glad that we got to have this chat and give a shout out to my buddy, Dr. Rob Bell, who brought my attention to you and your community. So, thanks, Rob.
Yeah, Rob's awesome. Rob was my first and only in person podcast guest here in Indiana so far. Gotta find more Indiana people to do podcasts with.
Exactly.
Right on, Luke. Hey, thank you, buddy.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
Best of luck to you.
Thanks, man.
All right. Bye-bye.